Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. I'm Mark Labriola, and in this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. William Dietz, a keynote speaker from Overcoming Obesity 2019, about the rise of childhood obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hello and welcome to the OMA podcast. This is Dr. Nick Pennings. I'm chair of family medicine at Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and executive director for clinical education at the OMA. And I have with me here Dr. Bill Dietz. Dr. Dietz is the Summer M. Redstone Chair of the Global Center for Prevention and Wellness at the Milken Institute of Public Health at George Washington University. He's also the director of the Stop Obesity Alliance. He's past president of the Obesity Society and the American Society for Clinical Nutrition. He's also former director of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at the CDC. Welcome, Dr. Dietz.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Dr. Dietz just gave a nice presentation on childhood obesity and its effect across the lifespan. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about obesity in children. And one of the concerns is that obesity rates have increased considerably over the past three decades. What do you see as the relative contributions of nutritional intake, physical activity to promoting obesity in children?
Well, I'm often asked about the increases in childhood obesity and what's changed. And my answer is everything. The foods that we consume, the availability of foods that we consume, the opportunities for physical activity have all decreased, the opportunities for physical activity have diminished over time, in part because of community design. At the same time, the availability of foods, the quality of those foods, the high caloric density of those foods has increased. So I don't think we can point to any single change as responsible for the obesity epidemic. But what's interesting is that we published a paper some time ago showing, looking across ethnicity and age in the U.S. population, and the curves of obesity in children and adults were parallel, beginning in about 1980. And when we looked internationally, there were also a series of parallel curves, regardless of country income, suggesting that those exposures that caused obesity were not limited to the United States, but there were universal changes in physical activity and nutrition. That these changes were universal suggests that there's no single smoking gun, that all ages, all ethnicities, all countries were affected. And That means that we can't look for a single cure. And what we need to understand is how we can control obesity now, not how we can prevent what happened 30 years ago.
And in parallel with that, have the changes in access to food and physical activity also occurred uniformly on an international basis?
Well, I can't answer that question internationally, but I can certainly say in the United States, yes, that the changes in food availability, the caloric density of foods, the availability of physical activity has changed considerably. For example, PE used to be a regular occurrence in schools. Now it's pretty hard to find. So children are less active as well as overfed.
And the freedom to be active is a little bit different in children now, too, that children don't sort of kind of leave the home and run out and play all day and come back for dinner that may have happened in generations past.
True. Perceptions of neighborhood safety have changed. I think when many of us were growing up, going outside after school to play in the neighborhood was routine. But I don't think we see that anymore. I think children are more tied to screens, and there's a greater parental concern about safety. And furthermore, many children come home before their parents. So there's no way that the parents are going to let them play outside if they're not around. So I think all those changes have been important. The other change that I think is not as widely appreciated is the importance of access to opportunities for physical activity. We know that parks and recreation facilities within a half a mile of where somebody lives are much more likely to be utilized than not. And yet in the design of many of our suburbs, that's not possible. An additional an additional characteristic of our suburbs, which have expanded rapidly, is that they're not connected to places where people want to go, and at least not connected by way of physical transport, walking and biking. So you have to get in a car and drive out of your community to get to a school, to get to your church, to get to a shopping center, and that's a significant change over time.
So in 2017, an alarming study looked at the projected middle age obesity rates in children today. The study projected that the current level of childhood obesity predicts that 57% of children today will have obesity by age 35. Do you agree with that assessment, and what can be done to lessen that risk?
So the study didn't show that children who were obese now would have this obesity at age 35. The study showed that among two-year-olds today, the prevalence of obesity would be almost 60% at age 35. That should be a wake-up call. The studies that were done to put those data together came out of five. The data that were used to put that study together were five longitudinal studies. So it was a very robust study. The other thing that people don't notice about that curve is that there was a plateau in adolescence, and then the curve continued to increase in young adulthood. And that's been one of my foci recently, is the importance of obesity in young adults aged 20 to 39, where we know that 23% of women and about 13% of men gain 20 kilos or more during that period. So that's a major risk factor for the development of obesity, and one which I think is important because if we can prevent obesity in those young adults, we may be able to prevent obesity in their children.
So did the weights of children impact what the weight was going to be as an adult? Did it predict? It was our correlation mm-hmm. between what a childhood's weight is at a young age versus and what they might be at risk for developing later on in life.
So we're not talking about that New England Journal study now, or just in general. What we know about the persistence of childhood obesity is that the later the onset and the more severe that obesity is, the more likely it is to persist into adulthood.
We often think of protein as beneficial for weight management. You discussed a study that found that high levels of protein intake increase risk of obesity in children. What do you attribute that increased risk of obesity to?
So I think we don't know exactly. There were at least two factors. One is that the branched chain amino acids in protein are insulinogenic, and that may have increased IGF-1 and led to fat deposition and rapid growth. And the other characteristic of breast milk, which is not widely appreciated, is that the most prevalent amino acid in breast milk is glutamate, which has a satiating effect on appetite. So there may be this duality of the increased protein in infant formulas leading to obesity and the protective effects of glutamate in breastfed children protecting against obesity.
How do maternal food choices during pregnancy and lactation subsequently impact the eating habits of infants and toddlers?
There's a really interesting literature which suggests that that elements of the maternal diet are transmitted to the fetus through the amniotic fluid, so that an infant swallow amniotic fluid in utero. So the fact that the infant is exposed to the same foods as the mother is consuming may channel their intake of those foods later. It may make those foods more acceptable later, So the diversity of the maternal diet and the kind of spices or whatever that is included in her diet are actually transmitted to the fetus and may increase the likelihood of intake of those foods later, or the acceptability of those foods later.
And that also applies to young children as well, and early exposure to certain foods affect preferences later in life?
Absolutely. So Leanne Birch, who was just the leader of this whole field, showed that you often had to introduce foods multiple times before they were acceptable to these children, before they became part of their dietary intake. And she did that without pressuring children to consume those foods, because we know that pressure is associated with the reduced intake of those foods. What she didn't show was whether the foods that she consumed during her pregnancy that were transmitted to the infant made those foods more acceptable later on. I mean, it wasn't We know that it is, but it wasn't systematically studied. So instead of having to try a new food 20 times before a child took it, the child had been exposed in utero, maybe it took 10 opportunities. That was not shown. It just wasn't studied, to my knowledge.
Early exposure to sweet and salty type foods also increases a preference for those foods later in life?
Well, all infants are hardwired for sweet. I'm not sure that they're as hardwired for salt, but the hardwiring for sweetness is probably protective and dates back to our early origins, because we know that the more bitter foods are more likely to be associated with toxins in the plants. I don't know the same thing for salt. I don't know. I'm not aware of the literature on the canalization of salt intake or the preference for salt.
Okay, but early sugar intake.
Early sugar certainly does, yeah.
Certainly. What role can schools play to improve obesity rates in children? And should the focus be on school meals, physical activity, nutrition education, or all?
So like early care and education centers, schools are a place where children spend a lot of time and where their diets and physical activity patterns can be molded by the environment in which they are participating. Schools have gone a long way under the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act and the Obama administration in terms of changing the types of foods available in the cafeteria, and those changes were not associated with an increase in plate waste, suggesting that kids were consuming a healthier diet. Schools are also one of the few safe places where children can be physically active. And the elimination or reduction in physical education, as well as in many settings, recess and classroom breaks, I think has had an adverse effect on learning and has increased behavioral issues. Because I think children often need to run off that excess energy. Children often need to run off that excess energy. And if they're not given that opportunity because they don't have physical education, they don't have recess, they're going to have behavioral problems in the classroom. So I think that we need to restore physical education, or at the very least teach teachers how to help their kids have brain breaks when the classroom's getting out of hand.
Does insulin sensitivity play a role in that increased activity as well?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I've never heard that.
In adults, we see a sedentary lifestyle is associated with increased insulin resistance.
Just in the absence of obesity?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. I don't think that's been studied in kids.
What do you think is the most important thing that healthcare providers can do to help children achieve and maintain a healthy weight?
Well, I think, pervasively throughout the whole society, the issue is stigma and bias. And I think that one of the first steps is that pediatricians and family practitioners and others can take is not blaming parents for their child's obesity. That doesn't solve the problem. Parents often share that problem. I think that the family unit, the family constellation, should be the target of therapy, because what the child is doing is a consequence of what the parents are, the environment that the parents are shaping. And recognizing that more holistic approach, I think, is critical. One of the things that I've often thought that would be a novel and important change in practice is when parents come in with a child for the child's obesity care, we ought to be weighing the parents. And when I was seeing patients, I would see the whole family at the first visit to begin to understand the dynamics within the family. Because often for families, weight is not the preeminent issue. It may be for us as providers, but for the family, poverty or lack of documentation or food insecurity or housing insecurity may have a much higher priority than obesity. And unless we take that social context into account, we may be creating a problem rather than solving a problem. So I think a holistic approach, one which in which we're sensitive to our own bias and stigma and we don't transmit that to families, is the way to begin to engage with families in a positive way.
And when I work with families, I encourage them to create a microenvironment of health that is focused on the whole family and the whole household, that centers around both the food, the physical activity, the screen time, all those factors, I think, are very important in looking at that whole family approach.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for your insights, and we appreciate your contribution to the OMA and your lecture today. and look forward to hearing you again.
Good. Well, you're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings and Dietz. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show hosts and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.